Give me six numbers.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
There's five.
There's a total.
Oh, then six.
Okay, so we have problem statement. Research questions. Review. Procedures. Quality control and code. Okay, let's start with Katrina.
Okay.
22, 8, 38, 13, 7, 88. I went back to my original numbers. Okay, Jared. Nice percentage. 23, 9, 35, 13, 8, 88.
Slightly different.
Okay, Melinda.
Are you gonna have to skip me? Because I obviously can't do math. But I'll tell you the numbers first, and I'll come back with you.
Okay.
Total. So 18. 6, 35, 12, and 8. And let me double check my math.
Okay, Jared. Doug?
15, 7, 15, 7, 30, 10, I didn't like it when I said, and 3.
Oh.
I haven't added it, I apologize.
Ryan?
I understand your struggle.
9, 39.
You're not getting a
smiley
face.
15, 8.
I did do it right.
Or excuse me.
93.
Okay.
Okay.
Can someone help Doug add?
65.
Okay.
Wow.
Mine was 78.
That was a little harsh.
Hey. They deserve.
I didn't say Doug couldn't add. I said, could you help me? Okay. Well, more variability. The fact that this person, that English isn't her native language, probably contributed to some of your ratings. Mm-hmm. I tried to keep that separate, but it's hard to at times. So, okay, so problem statement. What did you, let me see, Doug and Melinda liked at least. So what didn't you like about it, Doug?
I had to read it 10 times.
Okay.
I don't really like that.
No, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, I've said in here over and over that it's not good enough to come back and say, but it's in there. If you just look at it carefully, mm-hmm. No, it does have to, it should jump off the page at you. I mean, that's the purpose of a problem statement. Mm-hmm. You're the attorney and that's your opening argument. You say, in the next 2 days, I'm gonna prove to you A, B, C, D. So, okay. Do you have suggestions of how she could have written it more clearly?
Well, I'm really naive to this topic.
Yeah.
So I think things just should have been defined more clearly.
Okay.
I was not following her.
That's probably why we both ranked it a little higher, because I understand you a little more.
Yeah, and so that's a kind of a natural tendency that you kind of fill in the blanks.
Yeah, I didn't need the explanation. I was like, I understand it.
Yeah, okay. Okay, so someone outline her problem statement for me. Different bullets. Don't even have to be complete sentences. Okay, Ryan?
Questions are good for learning. Adjunct questions help gain comprehension. The harder the question, then the better for retention. And the research hadn't been done on just the dynamics of the question itself. The complexity or the level of thought that went into that, so she needed to conduct the research.
Okay. Is that what everyone else thought?
Give me circuit processing.
The first two I was in agreement with, but then, you know, where you said that, you know, questions help people learn, and then adjunct questions are that second one, but then the third one I would have said, however, we still aren't sure which type is the best.
Okay.
I think it's mostly along the lines, for me it was a clarity issue, that there were all these studies that have been done, but nothing really focused it on adjunct questions specifically. So
okay,
we're going to go through and do a meta-analysis to clarify that issue.
Okay. So where did her problem statement end up?
You know, honestly, Dr. Wayne, I can't understand.
Okay.
I read that and I reread it and I was like, okay, the present study is to use meta-analysis technique to study specifically the relative effects exerted by higher order or lower order adjunct questions on the comprehension and retention of reading materials.
I thought she went from clear to problem statement to less clear, but I think the question ended up, I shouldn't be saying I think the question is, but it is higher level questions, are they better or worse?
Okay.
More comprehension.
I think that's where she ended up, and if I were to go over her problem statement, I'd change it a little bit. Just from what you went, basically the same thing. Be like levels of processing is true. Use of these adjunct questions is ubiquitous, but we don't really know if they work. People have tried to see if they work, and we don't. It doesn't give us a clear picture of it because they haven't done this and this. And so the ending portion of it is, so a study needs to be done that shows that does use these components. And comes up with a clear is higher versus lower in and of itself better.
Okay, so we've harped on here about not using jargon, but let's just, I think with a little more work we can get around that, but let's just for a moment assume that adjunct questions is not jargon, okay, so that we all understand what that means so we don't have to dance around that issue. I think her problem statement could have been fairly clear. She just ended up at the wrong point. So when she ends up, she does end up saying, therefore, a review of literature has to be done.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not really where she wants to end up. She wants to end up saying that a study has to be done.
Mm-hmm.
And so mm-hmm. the review of literature, she's already done, and she should have incorporated what she learned from that review of literature into her problem statement. And so that the review of literature is to support the assertions in your problem statement. And she's done that work, so she just ended up in the wrong place.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if she hadn't done that, I would say her problem statement is higher order questions leads to higher order learning, but that may not be true for adjunct questions. So that's number one. Number two is there's disagreement over whether higher order or lower order adjunct questions are better. In other words, research, I shouldn't say disagreement, past research has yielded conflicting findings over whether higher order or lower order adjunct questions are better. Three, previous research of adjunct questions have not controlled for a number of extraneous variables, A, B, C, and D, okay, and name what those are. Therefore, another experimental study of adjunct questions is of higher order and lower order adjunct questions is needed. Which would control for the following features, A, B, C, and D, and use the same A, B, C, and D, which is essentially what Jared said, okay?
Yeah, but she didn't obviously, I put that in myself.
Right, so that's not what she did, but she had all of the material there to really have a great problem statement, but she kind of got lost a little bit in doing it, okay? So the take-home messages from this for you are don't end your problem statement by saying we need to do another review out of the literature unless that's what your study's going to be. There are some studies where you might say, for example, there's been hundreds and hundreds of studies conducted on what constitutes quality daycare for children. There are dozens of reviews that have tried to sort out and organize this literature. Unfortunately, those reviews reach conflicting results because they weren't done correctly. A method of doing reviews that would help us to sort that out would be A, B, C, and D. Therefore, a study needs to be done in which such a review is done. That is possible, but that's not what she was doing here. She was clearly proposing, when you got to the end of it, a primary research study, but her problem statement ended in calling for another review. So your review, in almost all cases, will be finished by the time you write this, and you're supporting the assertions. And even in the example I just gave you, the review would be finished, because it would be a review of reviews. I mean, you would be doing an analysis of previous reviews and saying, none of these are adequate, therefore we need to do another review. Okay. Let's skip down to her review of literature. So we're going to sort of set aside the fact that her problem statement wasn't structured quite right, even though one of our criteria for judging a good review is how closely it parallels the problem statement. We're going to kind of set that aside because it would be double jeopardy, perhaps, to critique her twice on that. So out of how many points we got on?
40.
So you all thought, Doug's the low one again, but most of you liked it. So let's go the opposite way here. So Katrina, you liked it a lot. If you were using this as an example to show other people how to write good reviews, what things would you emphasize that she did well?
I liked why she explained why she didn't use certain articles. What were her criteria for inclusion and exclusion?
Okay.
And I liked how she organized it according to each of those bullet points of why she included it. And then
tell me more on that one.
Well, I'm trying to remember the page number. Give me a second. On page 318, it's the sixth page of the set. She goes through and discusses these various points. And then she connects it to page, give me a second. When she starts discussing, as far as I remember, she starts discussing her tables and analysis and how she did that. Like text length, year of schooling, time. It wasn't necessarily ordered the same way that she had it, but she discussed each of those points. Relation between adjunct question, formatted question, criteria, and the test.
Okay, so let's try and restate what you said. So what you like about it is, number one, that the way she selected her sample, so how she decided which studies to include, has good exclusion, inclusion criteria.
Right, and she
And I'm putting
that.
Words in your mouth here, but I'm assuming you're saying that from what you know at least, and from what you could tell internally here, she probably had a pretty representative or comprehensive sample.
As far as I can tell,
right.
Yeah.
The second point was that she did a nice job, in your opinion, of looking at how subject and study characteristics co-varied with outcomes.
Right, and how she organized it according to describing the table and then gave the table, and then described the table and then gave the table.
Okay.
I appreciate that ordering system.
Okay.
I know it's required by APA, but it's
really... Lots of people don't do it in APA.
So a lot of people don't do it, but it's one of my preferred methods because it's easier to reference the table and it's easier to understand the information being given.
And so you could see clearly how the data she was citing was connected with the conclusion she was drawing.
It was a little goofy, some of the stuff that was showing up, though. So
now that doesn't tell me much. Let's try.
Like when ES, pound sign ES, showed up in the table, I still am kind of questioning what that is.
Okay. Number of effect sizes, I think, but
that's
you wouldn't be
too.
Expected to know that.
But I didn't know that.
Right.
So.
Mm-hmm. So our tables could have been clearer.
Yeah.
Okay, what else did you like? What else would you use from this to say to someone else, this is the way you ought to do it?
Her results, and I think it was her conclusions, were drawn directly from, it didn't skip, leap, and jump, except for, where was it, point 2A? Yeah, point 2A was a logic leap for me, but.
Point 2A, tell me a little more.
Give me a second. I gotta find it. I wrote it down and I referenced it, and I'm trying to remember where it ended up. It's not conclusions, I think it's under results. Oh, heavens above, where did it go? Oh, if anybody finds it,
17.
I mean, there it is. Yes. 2A. The present review shows that students already possess the cognitive decoding and processing skills and potential effects produced by higher questions would be neutralized. And the difference between high and low adjunct questions would be less pronounced. It was kind of a leap for me. Thus, it seems that possible that students of low ability might benefit more from low-order questions, while students of high ability are less likely to be affected by question level, unless they're drawing from the elementary, high school, and college level equivalency that they were going from, but that's kind of a leap there too.
Okay, you've lost me. So what is it? So what is it you don't like?
She never did a table according to ability level.
Okay.
She never looked into the research of ability level. She only looked at grade level.
Okay.
And for me, that doesn't equivocate to ability.
Or equate. Probably equate. Does equivocate.
Sorry, equate. Sorry, it does not equate
that's
to
okay.
ability level. So for me, that was a leap. But everything else was wrong from the literature.
And so, you're saying in most cases, there was a clear connection between her conclusions and the data that she cited. But on that one point,
it was a leap. I was just... I was a little iffy on that.
Instead of saying a leap, just say that she didn't substantiate that.
Okay.
You couldn't see. Okay, what else? Anything else that you thought was done particularly well?
I think that's it.
Okay, so let me see. Doug and... mostly Doug on this one.
Doug.
Sorry, guys.
Okay, what didn't you like about it, Doug?
You know, I fell asleep reading it.
Okay.
Maybe I was way too harsh. I think that it was all preloaded from the problem statement. And it started me off with a bad taste in my mouth. And
that happened.
In reading the review, I seriously did. My mind wandered multiple times. I had to bring myself back to make myself focus on what they were talking about. And maybe I should apologize for being so harsh, but it didn't capture me, and I know that's not very specific.
Okay.
Sorry.
Okay, what advice would you have for her?
Well, one of the things, let's see, just at the beginning, when she's starting to review the article. I'm trying to find maybe a page that would talk about what I'm talking about here. When she was going through and reviewing the different studies, I felt like there wasn't a lot of flow between...
Reviewing the different studies or the different reviews?
The different reviews,
okay.
Is what I should say.
Okay, so pages 3 and 4.
Yeah, I didn't feel like there was a lot of cohesion, I guess, between paragraphs and between studies. I felt like it wasn't placed in an organizational construct, that I was just kind of reading each of these individual syntheses. And I think that maybe that's probably the biggest issue I had with it.
Okay.
And maybe no one else felt that way. Could have just been me, and that's...
I felt she could have named them differently so that they correlated a little better to the points that she was making earlier. That would have been a bit clearer, but she hit every one of them that she was discussing.
Wait. Use specific terms, Katrina. What are you talking
about? Page 318 and 319, the 6 bullet points.
Okay, but I think Doug's way back on page 313.
I know, but he's saying that the organization is at fault, and I'm saying there was an organization, it just wasn't in order, if that makes sense.
I don't know. I kind of agree with what Doug's saying.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got 5 different reviews cited on pages 4 and 5.
Hold on a second, 4 and 5?
Page 313 and 314. Sorry, two different sets of numbers.
315 and 314, okay.
Okay, and at least, don't let me put words in your mouth, Doug, but I wasn't sure where she was going on citing those. I mean, there was a requirement that, and we've talked about that in here, that you look at previous work on the same or related topic, so she had an obligation to do that, but it wasn't clear what the point was that she was trying to make. And so just citing previous reviews and talking about them for a few sentences isn't enough. It should be leading you somewhere. And I think there's a place which we imputed to her problem statement where it should lead. I mean, what she should be doing here is saying, you read these previous reviews and they don't tell us whether higher and lower order adjunct questions whether higher order adjunct questions are better than lower order adjunct questions. And these reviews don't account for the following six variables. And they come up with conflicting conclusions, therefore another review is necessary. So that it comes back to what Doug said earlier, I think you don't have to read it three times. It jumps out at you. You say, this is what we learn from reading previous reviews of this set of literature. And what we learn is that we've still got work left to do, okay? And then similarly, that carries over to some degree to the point she hits on pages 315 and 316. So she says there's seven different variables here that I'm gonna talk about. And she names those and gives some examples. But then, and then you're right, Katrina, she does talk about most of those in her section on 318 further, okay? Mm-hmm. But then, how well does she include those in her proposed research study?
Are you talking chapter 3 or chapter
3? Well, chapter 3 is the results where she hits most of those, but then her proposed research study, which is what she labels as chapter 5, which is the point of all of this, okay? That's why you're doing the review, is to decide what kind of study should be done next, okay?
See, I thought that's what she was doing when she went point by point. She said, here's one consideration, and then she reviewed the literature on it and said, that's been covered, this has been covered, this has been covered, here's mine. That's okay. Why this one's next.
Okay, now, so, and how well does she incorporate what she learned from pages, well, let's do it this way. On pages 315 through 316, she lists 7 points. And then she reviews the literature about each of those points and draws some conclusions. Her proposed study should be done in a way that the questions which have already been answered sufficiently don't need to be repeated. And the questions that are still outstanding are addressed directly. Does she do a good job of, first of all, convincing you which things have been sufficiently researched that there's no longer any question about them, and those that still need work done, and of incorporating into her proposed study the things that still need to be done?
Well, she does that in chapter 4, to some extent.
To some extent.
With conclusions.
Okay. What I'm saying, probably didn't ask the question. So if she does that, how well does she link it to chapter 5? Jared?
So we start chapter 5, and I think our numbering system's different. It says 331 on mine, or 19, but she gives the three, this is what we're gonna look at.
Oh, our numbering system is slightly different. My numbers are probably old, so. Let's just use the little numbers, okay?
So little number 19. She gives the three, this is what we're gonna do. And like the first one, what type of questions would be more effective to learning of factual information? Mm-hmm. That really wasn't addressed in her lit review. The next one, what type of questions would be more effective? I didn't notice that one. And then if the levels of questions would affect comprehension, I think that one was, maybe directly in some places, indirectly others answered. But the first two, we really don't have much information. Mm-hmm. So if she brought it in as a, this is what has been done, this is what we do know, this is what we don't, and this is what I'm gonna add on to it or something, that would be great. But she's kind of, there's nothing, there's no buildup.
That's right. There's not a logical sequence. Mm-hmm. And in fact, there's a fair amount of stuff that gets addressed in her results, interval between studying and test, for example. You know, how does that analysis affect what she's proposing? Mm-hmm. If she's gonna spend time in the review on it, it should either be to say, this issue's been addressed sufficiently, I don't need to deal with it again, or to say, we still don't know the answer to this, therefore it needs to be investigated further, okay? So that's probably why Doug fell asleep, other than that he's been studying too hard and, you know, just working his fingers to the bone.
You just had a new baby, didn't you?
I did just have a new baby.
And that's probably why you really fell asleep. But it's that you found yourself reading a lot of extraneous material, tuned in. It's not focused in on the case she's trying to build for doing this particular study. So everything you write in your review of literature, you should be saying to yourself, how does this contribute to the conclusion that this particular study needs to be done in this particular way? Okay? And just because it's a study that relates to higher order, lower order questions isn't enough. Okay? And, I mean, it doesn't need to be 25 pages long. If you can make your case in 10 pages, great. You know? I mean, that's pretty tough to do. I'm not arguing that they should be 10-page papers, but you don't want to put any padding in there. You know, it should focus directly on the issue. Okay? All right, let's just go through a couple of other things here, sort of page by page. Talk about this a little bit, but to emphasize the point. So on page 4, little numbers, she cites 5 previous reviews. How good a job does she do about critiquing those reviews? In other words, could you, when you finished reading this, say there's 1 good review and 4 poor reviews? Go ahead, Rachel.
She just kind of summarized the previous research. So she really didn't say how one study differed from the other one or how they contributed to what she was looking at specifically, but just kind of summarized what happened.
Summarized what some of their conclusions were.
Right.
Okay. But you don't have any basis for knowing whether you should believe those conclusions or not.
Right.
Whether it's credible evidence. And so your job as a reviewer, whether you're talking about other people's reviews or primary research studies, is to let the reader know whether this is evidence which is credible or not. You know, you have an obligation to say, believe this, don't believe that. And you have a further obligation to say, believe this because, you know, to give me. So you're the prosecuting attorney in the murder trial, and the defense puts up a witness that says he didn't do it. As a prosecuting attorney, you want to convince the jury that that witness shouldn't be believed, right? And that's the same thing you need to do here. If there's a review or a primary research study, you need to convince me as a reader that I should either believe this or not believe it. And you have to give me some reasons for it.
Yeah, I think that was my biggest concern, was just the lack of synthesis.
Yeah.
It did just feel like these things were all in isolation. And it looked like often what I'll do is write a paragraph about a study or a meta-analysis that I read, and I'll write a bunch of paragraphs about different ones at first as a preliminary kind of thing. And then later I plan to synthesize and make sense of it, but it just kind of was left as this outline.
Right. And so the evaluation step is missing. I mean, it's not just a synthesis step, but there's a real obligation, a responsibility you have to evaluate that information and say, should it be believed or not? Okay?
Also, kind of that same kind of thing comes across when, I don't know if it's a she or he.
It's a she.
She is looking at the more recent studies that have been done, and that was kind of her reasoning at the beginning in her problem statement for doing another meta-analysis, just so that the more recent research could be reviewed. But the recent research is summarized in the table, but never really discussed never really explained kind of what happened. I mean, those studies appear in the tables, but she doesn't explain what any of those things evaluates them critically, I guess. It's kind of like they appear in the tables, the effect size and stuff like that, but none of that recent research is really compared to the other research that has been done before.
Okay, yeah. And you missed a little right at the beginning, Rachel. No, that's okay. Your comment's still relevant, but one important point is that she ends up her problem statement ends up saying, therefore I need to do another review. Her problem statement should have ended up incorporating the results of her review and saying, therefore we need to do another study.
Okay.
So, but, so just extending your point a little, go to page 9. And there's a table there. And she shows you the average effect size for high quality studies and poor quality studies, high versus control, low versus control, and then high versus low. Based on what you've read in here, what's the difference between a high quality study and a poor quality study?
In this paper?
Uh-huh. In this table. Okay, how did she decide what to put into a high quality category and a low and a poor quality category?
Right, it wasn't determined.
Right. Okay.
She gave a couple sentences. They're not helpful, but she attempted it.
Where are we?
On the previous page, the right above where it says purpose. Two criteria used to judge the quality of articles. First, sound experimental design. We don't know what she considers sound experimental design. A good article should clearly explain the design, the question construction, and the relation between adjunct question and criterion test question. And then second, appropriate statistical measures.
Right.
So it doesn't give much, but she did address it.
Yeah, she addressed it. So it's not well. Completely, but I agree with Rachel's comment that it's undetermined.
Yeah.
Okay. It's and as a reader again, so again, if you're the member of the jury who's going to convict this guy of murder or not, you need something more than someone saying, believe this guy. He's a good guy, you know, and he said he didn't do it. He must not have done it. You want some criteria on which to judge whether that person should be believed or not. So if you were giving this person advice, what might you have said to her about how she could have done that better? You're now all experts in adjunct and higher order and lower order questions because you've read this.
Well, I guess now that I think about it, a better definition of what she means with certain terms, such as good experimental design.
Okay.
Define what you mean by that.
So how might
control group did not.
So you're giving me advice. I'm the person that wrote this, and I say, oh, I'm not sure I understand. So tell me more.
So define.
Because if you can't explain it to her, you probably can't explain it to yourself. Because
right.
I'm going to critique you in this same way. You're all going to say when you do your review that these were good studies, these were bad studies, because I've harped on it so often. But if that's all you say, you're not going to get a good grade. So what do you need to do?
I guess then my question would be, what were you...
No. I'm asking the questions.
Okay.
You're giving the answers.
You need to say why they were good studies and why they weren't, I would imagine. So it's very explicit to the reader why they were good.
So talk about threats to internal validity.
Yeah.
And design of the study can play a role. To the extent that it controls threats to internal validity. I think those threats are going to be the primary thing to focus on. You can look at external validity as well. I mean, that's a factor.
Hold the thought about external validity, because you're all going to have to decide why you're going to have to deal with that, and but I don't let me forget it. We'll share responsibility. I'm not remembering that. So what do you say? So to determine whether studies were good or bad, I went through and looked at the following 7 points of internal validity and judged it based on that and put them in a higher low category. Would that make it any more clear how she made her decision?
A little, but not much. Not enough.
Yeah. Are you happy still? I mean, if that's all.
If she took a step further and went through and explained which was experimental control group, which was single case study, which was how the designs were classified, and were they done well according to those classifications?
Okay. So here's the strategy that I found to be most useful. One is perhaps you might want to have an appendix where you actually list the studies and show how you've coded things.
Yeah.
But that's an ancillary. The best approach I found is to have some sort of general statement of the kinds of issues that you looked at in this particular body of literature. in terms of what contributes to a high quality or low quality study. But the generalities never work very well. So what you need to do is take the next step and say, for example, the Smith and Jones study was classified as a low quality study because, okay? And then you go through and say, they had a control group, but it wasn't randomly assigned, and there was actually evidence that the two groups were different to start with, so this creates some problems with selection. In addition to that, the test was administered by the person who was doing the experiment, so there were concerns about instrumentation. It was also a very short test that blah, 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 blah. They lost 4 of the 7 subjects from their experimental group. So you just go through point by point with a specific example, saying, because of these factors that are associated with this study, I rated this as a low study. And then on the other side, you say, alternatively, a good study was the Broadbent and Williams study who did these things, okay? You've actually accomplished 2 very important things by doing that. You give the reader an idea of the kind of research that generally gets done in this area, okay? What kind of procedures get used, what sorts of tests are administered, who administers those tests, so they have a context. One of the big dangers with a quantitative approach, if you will, to reviews of literature is that people, when they finish reading this, don't have a feel for the research. It's just a bunch of numbers. And you don't want to do that. But in addition to that, you've given them 2, and sometimes, depending on how heterogeneous the area is, you may want to give 4 examples. Okay, give 2 bad ones and 2 good ones. Generally, I find that 1 good one and 1 bad one is enough to make it clear the kinds of decisions you're making that lead to a conclusion that this is a good study or a bad study. The other thing that does is it gives your reader an opportunity to see if they agree or disagree with you. I mean, because that's part of your responsibility too. And they say, I think that person's being too nitpicky, you know? I would consider that a good study just because they didn't have random assignment to groups. They had perfectly good matching. I don't think every good study has to be a randomly designed study. And so I don't agree with that. You know? Whereas the way she's worded it, it's so general that you have to agree with it. It just doesn't help you at all, okay? You looked perplexed, Rachel.
No, that's my thinking.
Okay, good.
It's just how I look.
I get perplexed when I think too, so. Or at least I look perplexed. Okay, external validity now. How important is it to deal with external validity in your review?
Well, if you want it to relate to anything you're doing, correct me if I'm wrong, external validity is the ability to generalize your conclusions.
Mm-hmm. That's correct. So how important is it that your review deal with external validity? Katrina says it's extremely important, I think.
Well, in order to design a study.
Do y'all agree? This is entrapment.
That's why I'm not answering.
I think it could go either way.
Yeah, I'm a fence sitter too, just like Jerry.
With different things I've done already, we've done a review of literature and we included studies that didn't generalize well because they were from specific populations. But because of the trend, it did give support for what everybody else said, and so it's just another piece. And it was, and the good thing is that you can say, well, this doesn't, because of the type of population the study was performed in, it does, you know, it does have low external validity, but that's fine. We know that, we identified that, and then the study we ended up doing has very, very low external validity. Probably would only be applicable to schools in Utah with high Mormon populations. And,
okay.
And so it depends on your goals and what you're going to do with it.
So let me ask the question in a different way.
Okay.
I want to know whether giving kids orange juice increases their IQ. Okay. I'm doing a review of the research on that topic, and I found 20 different studies that administered orange juice to kids to see if it increased their IQ. If all 20 of those studies were done with 10-year-old Caucasian kids in Logan, I probably don't have very good external validity, right? However, if Some of those studies were done with 10-year-olds, some with 5-year-olds, some with 20-year-olds. Some were done with Caucasians, some with Hispanics, some with Mexican, with African-American. Some were done in the 60s, some were done in the 90s, some were done in 2000. And they all found the same results. Then, even though the external validity of any one of those studies is not very good, okay, the external validity of the group of studies is now very good. External validity is the ability to generalize your results to other settings, other people, other contexts, other kinds of implementations. If there's enough research out there that you can include examples of, or not examples, you have in your comprehensive body of research studies which addressed, which used all of those different contexts, times, peoples, etc., then the integrated review itself becomes evidence for external validity. That's the one way you establish external validity. The other way you establish it is that you project, based on the people included in your study, in your single study, how well it's going to generalize that, and you make a case for it based on that. But I think the best way to deal with external validity is by the weight of evidence of multiple studies that have been done with different people, different settings, different contexts. So it depends a little on the body of research you have. If the body of research you have is really all done with the same kinds of subjects in the same settings at the same times, then you have no alternative but to say, now how well does this generalize? I'm going to make a subjective judgment about that based on the evidence I have. As a reviewer of the literature, you can't go out and collect new data. You just get to interpret whatever other people have done. So in some cases, you may need to talk about external validity a lot. In other cases, the review does it for you. Okay. You still have to analyze it. You say, did they get the same results when we used young kids versus old kids? Okay. So it's both yes and no, Katrina, I think.
Depends on your question, then.
Depends on, not so much on the question, it depends on the set of studies you have available to you.
Okay, body of literature.
Okay. Okay, on page 6, I made a note that said, boy, you've done a great job of laying out what the 7 variables are that you think are interesting. My concern is that you don't tie those in well enough to your proposed research. Okay. The criteria for selecting materials, I think she did well. She makes a statement at the top of page 8. Because of time and cost constraints, the search did not extend to unpublished papers and dissertations. This tends to make the resulting effect sizes spuriously big. Okay, first, do you agree or not agree that she should have included, that she was justified in not including unpublished papers and dissertations? And secondly, do you think that would make the resulting effect size spuriously big?
Was this written before or after access to digital dissertations?
Before.
Then, if you're trying to do a submit, I'm just thinking of how long it takes sometimes for me to get dissertations from universities that don't have them up
right
yet. And if you're trying to write this paper in a semester, because I actually underlined that, and I was like, that was pretty interesting to me that she would even mention that. But it does make a difference, I think, in the effect size because of publication bias. That these are things, you know, kind of the File 13 thing we've talked about before, that if you don't have a study that shows results, you're not going to get published. So, like I said, kind of looking at the time period of when she wrote this and trying to get it done in a semester.
Okay, but but we're talking about what constitutes quality here, and so take away the semester limitation. I mean, that's a practical thing that you do have to pay attention to, but I'd say generally that's a bad idea in terms of what's best practice in doing reviews of the literature. To exclude unpublished papers and dissertations, I can't think of a study where you would want to do that. Okay. And especially nowadays, because they are often much, much easier to get.
To an Eric and digital dissertation.
You find a lot of your best information in unpublished papers sometimes.
Right, exactly. And so whether it's, you ought to make the judgment of whether this is believable information or not based on the internal evidence of that study, not on whether it's been published somewhere or not. And oftentimes some of the best information is unpublished. Now, if you were to sort out unpublished literature, would it make? Yeah, actually, this is unclear, isn't it? When she says this tends to make the resulting effect size spuriously big, does she mean excluding published unpublished papers and dissertation makes it big, or including them would have made it big?
Good point. That's not very clear at all.
Yeah, I mean, I just realized that just now. But the point I wanted to make is you don't know whether it's going to increase or decrease effect sizes. I mean, the file drawer problem would make you think that published stuff may have larger results. On the other hand, if it's a spurious result and published stuff is of better quality, then it would tend to reduce the results. I find in most of the bodies of literature I've looked at that the more poorly done the study, the bigger the effects in general. Okay. And so, but it does depend on the body of literature you're looking at. Depending on what kind of information you're analyzing, it would have been a nice touch in an appendix to have included a coding sheet. I don't think it's always necessary, but you're trying to communicate to your reader why they should believe the data that you've collected. And sometimes seeing how you've collected the data makes it easier to judge that.
Along with that question, would that count as part of the 25 pages at the end of the semester?
No.
No, okay, so appendices don't count.
Yeah. Just don't try and put the narrative you couldn't fit into the 25 pages into your pens.
Okay, no, I was just wondering, some people include like bibliographies as the 25,
yeah,
too.
I'm pretty loose.
Okay,
look at the table on page 11. Anything worry you about that table? So she's drawing conclusions about elementary, high school, and university. You can even read the short paragraph above it.
Admittedly, I'm a little confused by the table, but I think I'm getting what's going on here. And if I'm understanding it correctly, university students kind of show the poorest reaction to differences in these types of questions. And her, if I remember right, her proposed study is with university students. But
that's true. What troubles me a little is, where's the vast majority of the data that's already been collected?
University
students. She draws some conclusions about differences for elementary and high school students based on very thin data. And then so I think if I were in the jury box on this one, I'd say, I don't know. You know, I mean, the statement above for both elementary and high school students, high questions appear more facilitating than low questions, while for students in university, the high and lower order questions have approximately the same facilitating effect. There's enough data. Now, another thing about this table I don't know is which of those came from good studies and which came from bad studies, so I'd really want to know that. Do I trust this data, or have we lumped in a bunch of really schlocky studies? But even if I set that aside and say, I'm going to assume these are all good studies, I'd say, I'm convinced based on this that know what the effect is for university students, because there's 19, 27, and 20 studies, but with these others, there's only 2 versus 4 versus 3. I need to know more about those studies before I trusted them. So the important take-home message here is that having tabular representations is wonderful, but you have to be thoughtful about it, and you have to help your reader be thoughtful about it. You've read these studies, you've digested them and understand them perfectly. You need to communicate the critical components of that to the reader. Now, maybe those three studies in the upper right-hand cell there for high questions versus low questions, those are three different effect sizes. What if they all came from the same study and it was a poor study? Or what if they all came from the same study and it was a great study? You can't tell that. And so the reader needs some guidance to know whether to trust that or not. And you need some guidance to know whether how you're going to interpret it.
Also, why did she put the number of studies column in if it doesn't really match up with the N she uses in the difference? I mean, there's 18 university studies, but 27 of those were low quality versus control?
Yeah, I think what it is, and I have to go back and read it again, but is that there are 18 studies and those are number of effect sizes.
Okay, so not number of studies, but number
yeah,
of
yeah, I think. But that's not clear from this table, and it might have been clear from something she said earlier. I don't remember. Does anyone else? And if it's not clear earlier, then I'm just guessing, and I could be wrong. So she does have an obligation. That's a good point, Rachel. She has an obligation to explain that to you. Okay? All right. I gave it a 77. So most of you aren't too far off. I think there were some things that she did well. I thought her problem statement had all the elements it needed for a strong problem statement. She just didn't word it that way. And she ended up at the wrong place. But the fact that I could read this and then come up with a problem statement that made sense was nice. But I still... I gave it 18 out of 25, so it was on the lower end of what you guys did. I think it was nice that she looked at other reviews, but she could have been much more critical, constructively critical. I'm not saying being negative necessarily, but she could have helped us understand. It was nice that she looked, she identified early on what the variables were that she wanted to look at in her review, then she did tables to show us those. But she didn't connect it well enough to what either her problem statement was or what the reason was that she was doing it, and then most importantly, didn't connect it to the proposed procedures. So she really could have written her procedure section pretty well independently of having done this review, okay? And that's always a bad thing, okay? Could have done a better job of helping us understand what a good and a bad study was. Enough. All right, next week you're reading an article by Tufte, Edward Tufte. It's a great article. So it talks about how to represent information graphically or figuratively. And I think it really, one of the biggest challenges you have in doing a review of the literature is after you've sorted through all of this information is figuring out how to portray the critical elements of that to the reader in a way that they understand what you understand. So read that article carefully and we'll spend a lot of time talking about it. Anything else? Okay, let's quit.